Okay, welcome back. We're here at episode 170. Joe, how are you doing?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Hey, so tonight we're going to talk about the politics of slavery. But before that, of course, this week now, everyone's talking about the Supreme Court seat being filled. Donald Trump has rolled out, I think, a list of 20 potential candidates that he may nominate, rather, for the Senate to approve. Of course, the emphasis, I guess the presumption has to be a woman, right? Is that the...
Got to keep balanced, Tim.
It's like... So it has to be a woman, and because I think there's this Barbara Lagoa in Florida, and who's supposedly a conservative Catholic. I think she's married to a Jewish fella, and then there's this Amy Bryant, right? Barrett. Yes. Barrett. I'm sorry, Barrett, who has seven kids. Some of them are adopted or something, and so she's supposedly Catholic. And so we'll see how this is going to play out. Of course, did you see some of the hysterical rantings?
Yeah, I mean, it's been, just a classic American carnival of idiots and, triggered kind of people who are so, they just think this is so important, but they don't have the big picture, I think.
If the revolution continues apace, I don't know how relevant the Supreme Court's going to be. I mean, it's there to rubber stamp and to provide some, a patina of legitimacy to a system that's already rigged. So it has to maintain some aura or appearance of rule of law, right? But now we're reaching a phase where we now have a situation now where sitting Congress creators are threatening to riot if Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump do their constitutionally required duty, is name a replacement for the now deceased Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and for the Senate to carry out its advice and consent, and they don't understand it. Yeah, this is fruits of victory, the spoils of victory in political battles, when the sitting president has a right to name a the successor, the Senate being controlled by the Republicans. And I think it was Harry Reid did away with that 60% filibuster, so now they don't have that to hold right. back a vote.
I have a conspiracy theory that Ginsburg actually died like 2 years ago.
Oh yeah, I think for 2 years she's been a Muppet or something.
Yeah, and so they brought out the corpse at this time to create the 4-4 possible deadlock Supreme Court if you have a contested election. And so you'd have a contestation over the replacement for Ginsburg, which would be hopelessly, impossible to move forward. And then at the same time, you'd bring out the presidential election with both parties declaring victory. At the same time, you had massive riots, throughout the United States. So that could be the sunny scenario of November in the United States.
Yep. It's set up for that. You have this with this Transition Integrity Project. It's just kind of hinting at stirring up trouble.
Yeah. Hinting. They're just saying they're going to.
And it was the the former mayor of New York, Bloomberg, I think, has paid out $32 million in personal fines for felons in Florida so they can vote. Very generous of him.
He's got unlimited funds. But, the thing is, there is this ending of the rule of law. You can see it. And it's interesting, isn't it, that it started in Seattle just like the COVID virus did. Not far from Bill Gates's home, you had the autonomous zone, which was really the first sort of representation to the middle class that your legal sort of understanding of the world and culture was ending. And, the autonomous zone was the incremental insertion, of this concept, which now has gone to all these other cities. Portland is basically now just in a state of constant riot. Louisville, I guess yesterday, went into, a situation where the National Guard was brought in. But this is all small potatoes, Tim. When you have the contested presidential election, I think you'll really see an acceleration, you know, of the breaking down of the rule of law. I've seen some videos where the Antifa BLM guys have gone into some suburbs, or I don't think they're particularly far from where the mainstream is in these different cities, but I saw this one YouTube where a white guy came out of his house, had a shotgun, and it was being shot by a BLM protester, and he was laughing, saying, you know, this guy doesn't understand what he's facing. In other words, the amount of weaponry that he knew the Antifa guys were carrying. And this confirms or just underlines what we saw with the Kenosha riot with Rittenhouse, where so many of the BLM guys actually were carrying weapons.
Yeah.
So this is bound to end up with some OK Corral type moments, isn't it?
Well, it's being stirred up. It's obviously being urged on or egged on by powerful forces who really should be investigated. And the current FBI director claims that Antifa is not an organization; it's a movement. So he's denying. So you have that's the grounds for Trump to fire him. It's almost like when Hoover denied that the mafia exists, organized crime exists, there's an organized network, and this is a nationwide organized network there to spread mayhem and create disorder. And a good example of what's happened in Louisville, and this might get into our main topic today, you had the Breonna Taylor case, where you had this gal who was, sleeping with two drug dealers. And when the police came, it was first reported as a no-knock warrant. It turns out it wasn't a no-knock raid. They knocked, and he shot at him through a closed door. I think those facts aren't in dispute. And then the police returned fire in defense. Breonna Taylor was killed in the crossfire. But it has come out subsequently that there is transcripts of tapes where she's actually involved in the criminal enterprise in the drug dealing case. So, you know, play stupid games, win stupid prizes. A myth has been created where she was just, this is reckless police work, and she was caught in the crossfire, and this has become the grounds for this riot because they failed to pass down, the grand jury failed to indict the police officers for her death. Really, the person who fought her death is her so-called boyfriend, because he's the one that started the gunfire. But nevertheless, it's become a basis for this rioting and mayhem in Louisville. And none of this, of course, you read the standard, you know, mainstream press, none of these details are provided. It's considered one of these controversial cases. But again, what we have here is the, sort of this weaponization or instrumentalization of the race issue, which something that's been occurring for a long time in America, been exploited. And that's why, you know, we talked about the politics of slavery and how it has been utilized by greater powers to divide and conquer and create conflict in order to achieve, you know, an objective of more power and wealth. From the get-go, the favorite leftist tool to delegitimize the nation's founding is slavery. They argue, you know, the founders disregarded the promises of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, and you know that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, as Joe Biden would say, you know the thing, in his speech. Slavery wasn't unique to the United States. Slavery was a common practice of all ancient peoples, you know, Babylonians, Egyptians, Greeks, Persians, Romans. In fact, the term slave comes from Slav, and those were white slaves who were, I think, enslaved by the Romans. White slaves are very common in Europe from the Dark Ages to the Middle Ages, often enslaved by Muslims. It was only during the 17th century that the Atlantic slave trade began, with the Europeans assisted by Arabs and, of course, Africans. Nevertheless, slavery in the United States was always unpopular, and it was always controversial. It kind of developed before the nation, so it was woven into the fabric of the country before we were a nation. And so it became an integral part of the economy, particularly the agrarian economy. And, of course, although the South, most slaves were in the South, the North made a lot of money on it because it was the North that utilized the South's resources, but also the North also built all the clipper ships and the slave ships, and this also capitalized the New York banks and insurance companies, which inevitably would create the industrialization of the North, which the North would then marshal or leverage to destroy the South. But you know, George Washington, a slave, you this contradiction where even slave owners were critical of slavery. This is because it was sort of a dilemma. Because on the one hand, they were principally or theoretically against it philosophically, but never, on the other hand, they had inherited these slaves, and it was their responsibility to take care and raise them as all part of the culture. And so there was a discussion: how do we end this without creating just too much disruption to the economy or to society? It was a legitimate concern. George Washington wrote in a letter to Robert Morris: "There's not a man who wishes more sincerely than I to see a plan adopted for abolition of it." This is slavery. In the Constitutional Convention speech, James Madison said, "We have seen the mere distinction of color made in the most enlightened period of time a ground for the most oppressive dominion ever exercised by man over man." In James Madison's records for the Constitution, he wrote, "The convention thought it was wrong to admit in the Constitution the idea that there could be property in men." John Jay, in a letter to R. Lushington, "It is much to be wished that slavery may be abolished. The honor of the states, as well as the justice and humanity, in my opinion, loudly call upon them to emancipate these unhappy people. To contend for our own liberty and to deny the blessings to others involves an inconsistency not to be excused. Patrick Henry, I believe a time will come when the opportunity will be offered to abolish this lamentable evil." George Mason said, "The augmentation of slaves weakens the states, and such a trade is diabolical itself and disgraceful to mankind." There's a lot of talk about in the Constitutional Convention, there's a 3/5 compromise. And some people say, well, this meant that slaves were considered only 3/5 of a man. Well, that's not entirely true. That's a misrepresentation, because it was the South who wanted them counted 1-to-1. It was the North that required that didn't want to represent it at all. So there's this 3/5 clause, because they didn't think they were, you know, full citizens. And that's a, you know, reasonable position. So they had this 3/5 compromise. But the 3/5 compromise was there to limit the representation of the southern states, the slave states, in the Congress. So exact opposites. One of these rhetorical twists you get, and people aren't really taught the proper history of these things. But by and large, slavery now is just a convenient moral posturing that's used to sort of to reduce respect for the Constitution and deny legitimacy to what's called heritage America and to destroy what remains of it. That's what we see now going on today, how it's being explored. It's been explored since the Civil Rights era, because even to how the Civil War is treated up until the 1960s, slavery wasn't considered it was considered a cause, not the cause, nor the other issues, the tariff, secession, these things. The historiography changed regarding the Civil War as contemporary political interest changed. And that's where you see slavery becoming a major issue that coincides with the Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s and 60s and its reinterpretation, of the history of the Civil War. It's a fissure, if you will, or a point that can be exploited and to stir up trouble. And that's something that we can talk about in the course of the Civil War itself, leading up to it, how there were forces, the banking houses that were behind things like the Dred Scott case, the publication and promotion of Harry Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, the Bleeding Kansas incident, Bleeding Kansas, the idea of shipping guns into Kansas to start a civil war, John Brown's raid, and these things to stir things up to create what would become the Civil War, create this division between North and South, and this sort of these vulgar passions that took over and made the war possible. So that's my somewhat brief introduction to the issue.
Yeah, very good. Well, I'll give another one. Currently, the history of slavery is part of the cancel culture. It's being presented as a way to create the idea that America has always been evil. And so the people who are breaking the drugstore windows and dragging people out of cars are heroes because they're overcoming this systemic evil nation. To this point, the New York Times brought out what was called, they called the 1619 Project.
Yeah, just a coincidence.
Yeah, which gave the BLM Antifa crowd, more sort of documentation of the evil of the United States, and particularly the relationship between the country and slavery. The 1619 Project took the position that the Revolutionary War was actually fought to preserve slavery, and that slavery was the primary economic reason for the success of the country. These positions don't really have much in the way of documentation. There were historians, in fact, the New York Times' own historians or historians that they had hired to help with the project, when they actually read the final product, they said this is incorrect. Somehow, these ideas are have gotten into this paper, and we oppose them. But the damage was done because the purpose of it was obviously to link up into the BLM attack on the middle class, to give both in the culture of critique that's going on, both fire for the rebels, the people who are smashing things and pulling people out of cars, and also continue with the process of the psychological destruction of white America, so they can accept a new social strata in which they are not protected by the rule of law, and that above them would be this group which had was victorious. And so you can see then why how systematic this all has been with the Soros funding of the DAs and the mayors who would take this position of that the police could be defunded or disabled, and so the rioting can just go on unabated. You've had 100 days of rioting in Portland. I think the people are just being permitted. It's almost as though they are the middle class, and this is their product at this point, which is simply the destruction of the city. People know where they live. I mean, they have these military type camps. No arrest seems to be made. They seem to be impossible to control. And so, as I see it, what you're looking at is, an onset of a slave state, which is why it's so timely that we're talking about the politics of slavery, because it's obviously such a political concept. It has so much power and culturally. I was going to, mention that this isn't, unfortunately, in the abstract, because if you look at the omnibus bill that is being voted on in Australia and has already passed one of the two houses, they are talking about slavery for the inhabitants of Melbourne. I think, people should be aware of this, this bill will give powers to not just the police, but to designated authorized officers, which there's no limit and there's no protocol or participation by the citizens in how these people are chosen. It's simply they're a Praetorian Guard of Andrews, as best can be determined. And they are able, these officers, they can arrest people who haven't committed offense, but just are deemed likely. See, this is the thought police conspiracy theorist individual, kind of this would give them basically the ability to arrest anyone who was in political opposition. And what I think is the most terrifying is that it gives these people who are not elected, who are not trained, they are simply designated by Andrews, it actually gives them the power to take away the children of anyone who they feel is likely to spread the virus or commit thought crimes even. And they actually have I wasn't aware of this, but it's been pointed out to me that they have a criteria for putting taking the children and putting them out of home care, in other words, away from the parents, for up to 30 months. So this is basically the Brave New World that Huxley saw, where the state now, I mean, they aren't creating the children, but they're certainly going to be responsible for the education of the children. I mean, 30 months of government supervision. So this is also similar to the slavery that the serfs experienced during the feudal era. In that system, Roman magistrates could take children and move them to wherever they felt they would be more useful if they were too populous in one area. They had the ability, and obviously they would then take the kids and put them wherever they wanted to. The serf is like Slav. It's a word that derives basically from slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at what's going on in Victoria, I think you're looking at what the long-term plans are for the American middle class. I think it's being incrementally rolled out in the state of Victoria, particularly in the city of Melbourne, which is huge. I mean, it has 5 million people, I believe, in the Metroplex. So it's not a small area. But if you looked at the videos, you've seen these just overwhelming number of police that are, you know, monitoring the social distancing of very small groups of people on the beach. I mean, they're just extremely oppressive, really creating the sense of a Soviet style slave state. Boris Johnson is bringing out this group of six, 6 meters apart and six groups permitted in the establishment, the 666, little witticism by Bojo. But that's very much, you know, and on the way to a full-on slave state. I wanted just to mention, anyone who listened to us Saturday, there will be another protest march in London this Saturday in Trafalgar Square, I understand. And in Europe, October the 3rd, there could be a real massive one in Berlin. So we're hoping about that. But getting back to slavery, I just wanted to note that in the way it's being used currently, as that white people and white privilege are benefiting from the historical aspect of slavery, the history of slavery and the history of how, you know, it became part of our culture, I think, is important. I mean, certainly the Romans were, it was a slave culture. To a large extent. But in between the 6th and 12th, 13th century, there was this mysterious group, the Rodanites. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but it's a Hebrew word. And it was basically a guild of Jewish merchants that participated in slavery, trade. And they were international. This is what they were famous for. They introduced perhaps paper and paper certificates. And they certainly then were the founders of the idea of the letters of credit. And so it's very interesting that the Rodanites can well be seen as the precursor. In fact, they could well be the direct ancestors of the modern banking system that then sprang up, you know, during the middle part of the Middle Ages. And just finally, I just wanted to say that though white people are being accused of being slavers, and in some cases this is correct, I mean, there's certainly Europeans that participated in it, I would note that it's never really been made clear to me what the actual percentage of so-called Gentiles participated in the slave trade itself. Because if you look at the sort of the historical record, what you see are two groups that are very visible. You see Jewish slavers in the United States. They were particularly active in Newport, but they were completely established in the Caribbean. And Freemasons. The Masons were running the Dutch trading company that was the largest slave trade enterprise at the start of like the 15th, 16th century. And they were completely Masonic. And then they were put aside after a while by the British, the East Asia Trading Company, which was basically just part of Freemasonry. So these groups, there were the Masonic groups and Jewish trading enterprises and shipping enterprises, all of which, or much of which, were being financed through the Rothschild and other Jewish banking credit systems. If you look at the U.S., how cotton was financed, you'll see the Rothschilds were, you know, one of the more powerful groups involved, and their agents were also everywhere. And even though the family had denied it, then recently researchers have come up with all of these examples where the Rothschilds and the Freshfields, their Masonic legal company, had engaged in financing. And even though they weren't buying and selling trade slaves directly, they were financing the whole system. So they couldn't really claim to have, you know, their hands had been washed of this whole thing. And so my point being is that when the cancel culture comes at the white people, they really should try to do a little more digging into the actual history of it, because it would be interesting to see. It's an enormous project, and it's one that'll, you know, you're going to need to dig deep, because a lot of this was hidden, of course. But you'll see that, like in the Newport slave trade region, you have the two groups. You have Jewish or conversos who are involved in owning of ships, and then you also have Freemason systems that are interacting with them. And you know, they had what was called the triangulation trade, where boats would leave from Newport with rum, Africa, pick up slaves, take the slaves to the Caribbean, trade that for sugar, and then head back to Newport with the sugar to make rum. This was, as best I can tell, highly Masonic and Jewish. And so what I'm trying to do is just say this is being brought out against white people, but this is irrational. It is not nuanced. There is a whole world here of bias and racial propensities that isn't being disclosed when they just talk about white people and the white privilege that we have from slavery.
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of Southerners, like 84%, never owned slaves. It was the planter class that benefited from it, and everyone else paid for it, because this is an example of an elite importing cheap labor to lower wages of the native population, and then sort of just letting other people pay for whatever societal, social, cost or inconvenience this creates. So here you get another example of an elite or financial elite or wealthy tapping cheap labor and letting other people pay for it, all the social costs involved in that, and then not caring much of what the effects are on the on the overall culture, and that, you know, that's. Nevertheless, I mean, a lot of most people who did fight for, you know, the lost cause for the Confederacy weren't slave owners. They were fighting for their home against an invasion. And I mean, the popular understanding of the American Civil War was it was necessary to rid the country of slavery. And it was just sort of the suffering that the country experienced during the war was penance for its sins. Abraham Lincoln talked about this, of course, good way to pass off responsibility for all the carnage. It's God doing it, you know, not me, you know, but nevertheless, it wasn't necessary, because if you look at it if you look at the initial crisis of secession, it was the deep seven states that seceded initially in response to Lincoln's election, and then the border states didn't secede. This was Arkansas, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia didn't secede from the Union until Lincoln ordered an invasion, calling up 75,000 soldiers to invade the South. And this is what led General Lee to resign his commission and take up defense of Virginia as he saw it. And so that initial crisis, now what would have happened if Lincoln did nothing and let the Gulf State Confederacy, as it was called, secede? Well, the border states wouldn't have seceded, and then the Deep South would have bordered states where slavery was going away, or and simply would have wouldn't have this the institution of slavery wouldn't have the protection of the federal government anymore, which it did under the Fugitive Slave Act and the Constitution. People forget that decisions like Dred Scott, these were federal decisions. He had actually prevailed in the state court, and that's a whole intrigue to that case, meaning that because under federal law he was a free man under the at the time. So why all the litigation and why why did he and then the owner of freedom and right after they won, it was like, why go through all the trouble? But this again, the decision in Dred Scott created wide division in the country, particularly in the North, and the same thing with the fugitive slave laws. North didn't took umbrage the fact that it had to participate in the enforcement of these of slavery. Several states nullified these laws, like Pennsylvania. We're not going to enforce these laws. Nullification was invoked by the North against the federal law they found they didn't agree with. What happened if there hadn't been a war? Well, slavery would have gone the way would have withered away peacefully, like it did in every other country except Haiti, which had a violent slave revolt. So there's that. If you look at talk about antagonisms and kind of stirring the pot and creating trouble, there was a lot of money to be made by waging war and getting control of the banking system. That's something that the Civil War succeeded, letting the elites succeed in that endeavor, because in order to wage war, they would have to raise and go into a lot of debt. And centralized banking power. That's what occurred in the Civil War in order to finance its operation. And there are people who made a whole lot of money on, not to mention the centralization of power. It was, once again, if you look at behind the scenes, you have these great financiers, and that brings in the Bank of Rothschild. Some people speculate that Lincoln ran afoul of the Rothschilds because Lincoln failed to borrow money, as much money as he wanted. He printed the greenbacks, right? And this apparently upset their plans. They wanted the union to borrow money from their banks. Didn't do that. And so somehow this led to his assassination. And then you have in the middle people, like the John Wilkes Booth circle who are being utilized in this operation. It's not to say that everyone knew about it, but at the upper level, the meta level, this is being manipulated. I mentioned the book Harry Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. How this book, Harriet Beecher Stowe never set foot in the South. She knew nothing of slavery, how it really was. Yet she wrote this book, and it was almost like a movie or Hollywood movie at the time promoted, and it inflamed passions in the South because it insulted the South. It created a caricature of the South and the North, and it created this divide, thus making it a lot easier for the war to be waged. I think it was Lincoln himself blamed Harriet Beecher Stowe for the war. She said, "You're the lady who wrote that book that caused this mess." Again, passing blame off on her.
Yeah, I mean they set up basically false dialectics.
Yes.
They set emotional structures where people are forced to pick sides. But ultimately, in back of all of this, there are plans. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, often it's just population reduction, financial advantage. The wars are just almost religious pageants for slaughter and theft. To me, the most kind of amusing Civil War battle was Fort Sumter, which starts it. It was preposterous. You have the Freemason Pierre Beauregard commanding the Confederate forces, supposedly being told by Jefferson Davis to strike a blow. And of course, we've gone about Jefferson Davis's cabinet. It's 100% skull and bones, so it's a little suspicious. And the Fort Sumner garrison commander, Robert Anderson, was another Mason who then, after two or three cannons were fired, decided to surrender the fort, even though it was impregnable. And the next day he was evacuated and took a train back to Washington. So this was the battle that then became presented as this emotional structure to justify then Lincoln's action, which of course led to, you know, almost 4 million people, or excuse me, 700,000 Americans dying in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of them would have been Christian males. So this was really, I think, when you look at the Civil War, you're looking at an attack against the potential political power of Christian males. It was dramatically reduced by the Civil War. When you look at how the politics of slavery are being framed right now, with Black Lives Matter against these white militia that are popping up, this ultimately, to me, seems to be another way of not just in this case reducing the Christian male, because that's just part of it, but just of creating enough chaos so that the reset that's coming will seem to have been caused by these natural and unforeseen forces like the COVID pandemic and the this heroic rioting that's going on that's destroying our economic system.
Mm-hmm. And with the as with the Civil War, as it dragged on, it became an abolitionist crusade. It's a propaganda maneuver. The Emancipation Proclamation was issued, so it's a war measure to gain a propaganda advantage over the South. Slavery itself, if you think about it, this portrayal of slavery as being brutal, that itself is a caricature. Is it, most people think it's brutal. Well, no, actually, in most cases it wasn't. Sorry, it just wasn't. In fact, the average slave in the South had a higher longer life expectancy, a much higher standard of living than the typical wage slave in the factories in the North. And that this is something that's brought out in the slave narratives decades later, early 20th century, early 1930s, when under a New Deal program, where journalists went to this, fanned out across the South, and there was still some surviving former slaves in the South, and they actually waxed sort of nostalgic about the old days, about the antebellum period. And a lot of this could be because they were younger, but there's a lot of destruction in the South from the war. The Southern economy was destroyed, and with that, a lot of suffering, destitution, and starvation. And there's a great dying off of former slaves in the immediate post-war Reconstruction period. There is a William Sharkey was a former Confederate, and he became a judge, but before Congress, in describing the devastation, he wrote, "Armies of freedom and the great emancipator head upon the black race. I believe that there were now in my state very little over half the number of freedmen that were formerly slaves, certainly not more than 2/3. They have died off. There's no telling the mortality that has prevailed among them. They have died off in immense numbers. I should say that very little, more than half the amount of the land that was under cultivation before the war will be under cultivation this year." This is the destruction that the war wrought. And then, of course, it kept the South poor for decades later.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more with that description. The oligarchs could care less about the African Americans. That the whole idea that they cared about slavery, I think, is preposterous. I even think the founding fathers are being, you know, using sophistry when they talk about, the evils of slavery, because they were all participating in it, for example. But the ones who are Masonic, in the South after Reconstruction, they kept the blacks basically as slaves. Not well known, but there was indentured servants, so slavery under another name, that went on right up until World War II in the poorest states, in Mississippi and Georgia and these areas. And this is where, just to, you know, as a, to digress, this is the groups of blacks who were then brought up into Detroit, into Chicago, to after World War II, to break up the ethnic enclaves.
Mm-hmm.
So they were easy to get them to leave because they had kept them in these chain gangs and in these indentured servant roles.
Yeah, you keep the region poor and underdeveloped, and then when the time comes, you can tap their cheap labor to achieve another objective in the North, which
was break the
unions and break the ethnic neighborhoods up, which Michael Jones writes about in The Slaughter of Cities.
Exactly, yeah. And Jones does a great job in bringing this out. And so this idea that the Civil War was somehow to emancipate the slaves, when you stand back and look at it, is preposterous. The problem is, and this is a fact, or at least a point, that is brought up by the Antifa, Black Lives Matter sort of intellectuals, if you can use that expression, that no one really cared about the blacks during this process, that there was this systemic racism. But there was systemic racism. The problem is, when they hurled the charge against the white middle class, they just don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand that we have been an oligarchy from the beginning. And you see, this is the problem. When you don't know history, you are so easy to confuse.
Or against Polish, Irish, and German immigrants who came to the country in 1850, 1860, 1870, you know.
Yeah, and the poor African Americans, they were used ruthlessly, of course, in the cotton era.
Mm-hmm.
They were then used after the Civil War as to continue in farming, but now with not with the protection of slavery, which, as you point out, many times was a better living circumstance than factory workers, but they were just the poorest of the poor. They were kept as either indentured servant or often in these chain gangs. And so now that group is then used again as a sociological phenomena, just to break up these enclaves. And this was all being done by one group, you see. And if you don't understand that, then they really can't, you know, with the Black Lives Matter, where they feel justified in breaking the store windows, cars, pulling white people out of the cars.
Yeah.
They just hurl this charge against the entire white race, which isn't going to help them. This unnuanced approach to existence that they are being fed is only going to get them into a situation like the blacks after the Confederate Civil War, because the economy will collapse. Now, they'll have the cities, they will have driven out all of the whites, but what will they actually have in terms of commerce? So this doesn't go to a good place for them, in my opinion. I think they're being fooled and led into this. So slavery is once again just a political tool, because it's being used as the fake dialectic to stir up, the lumpen proletariat white and the angry blacks. And incidentally, just to digress again, I don't know if you've seen pictures or interviews with the white male Antifa cohort, but this is a new low for the lumpen proletariat. And it's just remarkable that they can even present these people as protesters. Because the ones that I've been watching, I'm trying to find ways to get a hold of some of these people. I mean, good luck, I suppose, but they're brain dead. I there's no way to describe it. They are just fentanyl and heroin has just taken their soul, and you know, they think they're going to be establishing a classless society. They couldn't define that any more than they could explain gravity. But this is what they've been told, and they're being paid some money. This, I'm sure, is coming through the, you know, the various channels which are associated with Soros. And so we're going to have a real nice civil war.
Well, it's like Bleeding Kansas. It's like Bleeding Kansas, where someone paid for Beecher's Bibles. Beecher's Bibles, that was Harry Beecher's father. He was a northern preacher, a rabid abolitionist. And they were smuggling in rifles and crates of soldiery Bibles to foment the civil war in Kansas. In the 1850s, and so again, who's paying for that? You know, why do you want this? Yeah, and because they want to stir up trouble. You want this dividing. They wanted the war, and now you know, it's like today. It's like who created these legions of miscreants and lumpen proletariats and freaks to go out and cause this mayhem? Who has the time? I mean, think about someone who's 28, 30, 35 years old, hanging out at an Antifa protest, pummeling people with your skateboard. Think about the station of life that person inhabits. That person should have a family, should have kids, and these things.
Premier intellectuals.
Yeah.
Skateboard and, guy who got his head blown up.
Yeah.
He could talk. They have, I mean, that is your leadership cohort. Below him, trust me, I have been studying these guys.
Yeah.
Get into, you know, quasi-human kind of configurations. It gets very, very degenerate. Very
well, our society is affluent. It's producing these people, and it's unintentionally doing it. And you have people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her ilk who inhabit the judiciary, or professors who've been teaching, you know, deconstructionism and critical theory and social justice warrior craft for 20, 30 years. They produce a whole class of people who think this way. And these people should not be entrusted with any position of authority or education or instruction, yet they have taken over these institutions.
You know? And they've taken over the mob. The Antifa and BLM is very interesting. Interesting sociologically. I'd love to be able to get in there and, you know, do interviews with all these people. There is a core. If you listen to like the three black women who were the so-called founders of it, which is obviously a preposterous notion, but
they identify as lesbian Jews.
Yeah, they have the typical cultural Marxist intellectualism. You know, their language is, you know, they talk about social structures and concepts and stuff. But the language in the mission statement, which you read a couple shows ago, could not have been written, in my opinion, by a black activist. That comes right out of the sort of the humanity departments of like a Jewish lesbian activist.
Well, Lightfoot,
it was classic in
yeah,
his language.
Yeah, Lightfoot, the lesbian black mayor of Chicago. Her wife, if you want to call it that, is a Jewish feminist.
Yeah,
she's an agitator.
And she could have written the BLM mission statement, but the point is that you can see how just completely artificial the group is. I mean, it's preposterous. The mission statement, it could not come from the streets. It wasn't written by some kind of drugged out white fentanyl person. There is a veneer of kind of mentally ill white girls with dyed hair.
Yeah.
Their intellectual level is low, but you know, they could at least probably understand what the mission statement was. The black males who are typically the ones who are dragging people out of the cars, I don't think they would understand it. They're clear-minded. Most of them are much more clear-minded than the fentanyl brigade, but they don't come from that world. They don't come from the world of the lesbian, transgender, intellectual theory world, you know, of the university. So there's just this veneer of sort of the people on top who have the idea of like what this whole thing is about. So that means that all of the people beneath them have some motive other than the intellectual structure of the organization to be there. Clearly they're getting paid money. Clearly there's a budget. Where is the reporting on that, Tim? why, what is the media blackout? What is in back of that? Because this has got to be one of the biggest stories since the Japanese invasion of Pearl Harbor. And there isn't anything about what is funding and creating the Antifa BLM protesters. There's a rumor that was circulated about, which I have no idea, you know, where the veracity of it, but I read it, that there are currently in hotels across the United States Antifa thugs being put up in 3-star hotels, waiting for the you know, election fireworks to spring to life.
Who's paying for that?
Yeah, and where is this money coming from?
So where's the forensic accounting and investigation?
Exactly, and, yeah. And so the accounting, the question mark, to me, this is the biggest story since World War II started, and there's nothing, not a single word being written about. When Newt Gingrich on Fox News mentioned that Soros had funded the district attorneys who had stood down the police departments and let the rioters continue, the Fox News talking heads all simply clammed up. No one even would go on with the conversation.
Yeah, it's like we don't need to talk about that. And you get, this is the former Speaker of the House talking to these news babes, and they shut him up.
And the Soros, Soros's control over open society and the money that went into these campaigns is public knowledge. This isn't even something that's, you know, in the realm of, you know, theoretical theory. This is well known.
Yeah, and so we have a private financier financing an insurrection, a civil war, and disrupting elections, disrupting communities, and there's no investigation. The FBI pretends that Antifa doesn't exist as an organization, or that no one's investigating Black Lives Matter and its finances, even though, you know, it's obvious what's going on here. They're being corporately funded. So how revolutionary can they be? You know, you have a situation, taking it back to like the Civil War period and the immediate aftermath, all this mayhem, and understanding what occurred in the South and the Jim Crow era, putting it in its context, why it was in the South, poor, depressed, and why there are so many blacks living in poverty and other whites living in poverty in the South. Well, it was an aftermath of the Civil War. Prior to that, the living standards were higher in the South, generally higher, as I mentioned. And so this the war created these conditions, particularly in the Reconstruction period, when you had hundreds of thousands of roving bands of so-called freedmen creating all types of crime. And then you had the occupation of the Union Army, and you had all the corruption occurring in Reconstruction South. I think they tripled, quadrupled taxes. They'd made off with the money, didn't do any infrastructure, and these bonds weren't paid off until like the middle of the 20th century. So people were being impoverished to pay off the money that was. Embezzled by carpetbaggers and scalawags that had gone down there. But this is the condition on which the era of Jim Crow existed, and the laws and the black codes and these restrictions. By the way, black codes were based on laws in the North. So if you want to single out the South, go ahead. But they were based on like anti-vagrancy laws in the North and these things. But it was meant to deal with a specific problem. This is also the environment in which the original Ku Klux Klan was formed. These night raiders and night riders, rather, they would go out and deal with these issues because of the anarchy that was unleashed by the Civil War and the occupation that lasted until 1877, when in the final Union Army American soldier pulled out. And the South got its independence back again, and they reinstituted the system. But that's the context of it. Then you have the poverty down there. Obviously, everything's going to be a lot worse in those conditions. Now, what would have happened if the South had been left alone to deal with these issues? It hadn't been a civil war, and they left to contend with the race issue, the slavery issue. It might have been a lot better. And but the North isn't willing to accept responsibility for conditions in the South, not to mention the fact the specific banking laws and discriminatory railroad rates that kept the South from developing because they wanted to keep it as a sort of a conquered province that you could extract cheap labor and resources from. And they did that for the better part of a century after the Civil War. The South really didn't recover economically until the middle of the 20th century when you had the introduction of air conditioning. And the sort of then you have the and then you have the situation where the big business in the North wants to weaken unions, and they start moving south and tapping the cheap labor. And as we mentioned, immediately during the First World War, particularly in the Second World War, how they shipped up a lot of people north and into up north to man the war factories and industries in the North during the Second World War. Then it became this plan to break up the ethnic. Particularly the Catholic ethnic neighborhoods in the North, by flooding those areas, integrating them, as they say, with black migrants. And this, of course, created the era of white flight in the suburbia, which is another social engineering scheme that they had. But either way, you have this exploitation of this issue, and this all goes back to the fact that they were able to keep a large region of the country, conquer it, keep it poor, and then exploit it for its resources, be they, you know, raw materials or even labor. And this issue is being exploited, and continues to be exploited today, because an outfit like Black Lives Matter, which is being used by the oligarchs to sort of disparage the white majority and deprive it of its rights and its claims and its position in the country by exploiting something like the race issue and the guilt issue. And this is this issue, and this all goes to the civil rights era. And it all goes back to the era of slavery, and it's the civil rights mythos or narrative, which is the new religion of the country. And it created a revolution of laws with the civil rights laws when they passed in the 1960s, when certain things like the right to associate, which is also the right to disassociate, was destroyed under these anti-discrimination laws that were passed with the Civil Rights Act in 1964. But it was a revolution because it overthrew much of the Constitution, because it created this whole regime of laws, massive coercive powers on part of the federal government to coerce. Not to mention the 14th Amendment, which is of course a product of the Civil War, which was passed for the most part to protect the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which is pretty much extend basic rights and privileges and immunities to the recently freed blacks. But subsequently, it's been interpreted in a way to create an excuse for judicial activism, to impose all sorts of radical politics on the country, and it's been picked up by feminists and gay rights. And obviously, the 14th Amendment, good examples of 14th Amendment, has been used to justify abortion on demand. It's also been used to create a constitutional right to gay marriage, but it can't be. Apparently, 14th Amendment can't be invoked. Because the 14th Amendment also created what's called the Incorporation Doctrine, which said that the Bill of Rights also applied to the states. Prior to that, the Bill of Rights was believed only to apply to the federal government. Each state had its own Bill of Rights. But under the guise of the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court created the Incorporation Doctrine. But we see how toothless that is, because in California, when some pastors sued the state government as a violation of their First Amendment right to free exercise of religion, Justice Roberts was there to say, well, no, closing churches isn't a violation of the First Amendment because there's an emergency. So much for the 14th Amendment and the Incorporation Doctrine when it comes to protecting real rights, but it can be invoked to create something like a constitutional right to gay marriage.
Right, and so there you have your 4-4 Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Now, going forward, we are obviously in a period where the politics of slavery are being used for malevolent reasons. What advice would you give to the two camps? In other words, we're looking at the militia, because I think almost all of the middle class can be seen now as a militia. They're frightened.
This is the radicalization of normies.
Right, the radicalization of normies. And then, of course, on the other side, you have, I think, the fentanyl lumpen proletariat cannot be addressed at this point, unfortunately.
Well, actually, Judge, this idea of white supremacist.
Yeah.
Whatever that is, what makes you white supremacist? It's not a legal term, but you hear it a lot, right? He's a white supremacist. Any white person, ethnic white, who asserts his rights, whether to self-defense, to protect his property, he gets involved in an altercation with a person of color. Well, one side immediately writes them off or criticizes them as a white supremacist, labels them a white supremacist, as if being a white supremacist means you don't have any rights. And effectively, that's true, I guess, given the current political environment, how the media treats it. But yet this guy, was it Jacob Gardner, who committed suicide after being indicted? He was in Minnesota, yeah. I think, and his business was attacked by rioters. And he successfully defended himself because he had a firearm from three or four assailants. He fired a warning shot off. He wounded one person. He was initially the local prosecutor following the law and based the evidence, said there's nothing to bring charges against this guy. Then he was pressured by the mob, and they brought in a special prosecutor, a former U.S. attorney, who did bring charges. And he facing, I guess this guy couldn't stand the pressure. He committed suicide. But it was interesting that there was a state senator up there, a Michelle Hunt, I think is her name. I forget that right. Called him a white supremacist. He's just a business owner who had a firearm. He had there to defend himself. But that now we get same with the young man in Kenosha. They're calling him like a white supremacist.
Which of course is ridiculous. But yeah. they're gaslighting.
My point is there's that race issue again. It takes us back to this is the politics of slavery extended. Yeah.
Guilt. The people hurling these charges at that level don't believe any of them. They are doing it because they're trying to attack the psychology of the white male. They would like the white male to be gaslighted, to not have a sense of self-defense. And just accept whatever Antifa will hand out.
Well, as things get. If things heat up, and they may well,
going to heat up too.
Things get worse as they wanted to get worse, and because the authorities are not doing their basic duty. So big point is the mayors, the governors, you know, even the press, they're not doing their basic duty of maintaining law and order. So they're helping it along by their passivity or their indecision or whatever, their fecklessness or their collusion in this stuff. Is that you're going to get a lot of white males, because the country is 2/3 white still, and these are the people who have agency, they have resources, they're armed, they're naturally going to coalesce and defend themselves against this mayhem. And now we're creating a situation where if you do that, this is a white supremacist militia.
I think that they know the whites are going to attempt to defend themselves and will defend themselves at some point.
Yes.
What's happening now is they're just trying to weaken us to the extent they can, and they're trying to give a rationale for the rioters that they're dealing against systemic racism and evil. They want to make sure that the white male is dehumanized. It's like calling a Vietnamese goop during training, you know, of a Marine during the Vietnam War. So the white male is the gook. We're getting training from the owners of the media to the combatants who will be coming against us that we are dehuman. And so I think that's really what the purpose of all this is. The ludicrous Lloyd George police murder.
Not Lloyd George. He was the Prime Minister of Great Britain.
So widely videotaped. But all of this is all of this is just to turn the white male into the gook, dehumanized to the combatants on the other side, to the Antifa, to the Fentanyl Brigade. Because eventually they're going to send this group into the suburbs, and that's when you're going to see the whites defend themselves. There'll be a slaughter because rest assured, this isn't going to be an even fight. The white males are well armed and know how to use them, and so there'll be a slaughter. There'll be mythology developed around it, but this will all be in the context of complete chaos, right? I mean, this isn't going to be the only battle going on at that time. You're going to have a financial reset occurring. And you're going to have a complete collapse internally of the economics in the United States. You could have an end of the dollar during this period. So it's going to be chaotic. And I think in that in that chaos, remember, they love chaos because they can then, you know, bring in their leadership, and we will be accepting it because this is the only way to restore order of some kind. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think we're going to be looking at over the next 3 or 4 months, is a contested election, very violent riots escalating and getting into the suburbs, where you're going to have a kind of pitched battles being fought. The media will be characterizing the whites as supremacists and white privilege. There'll be cultural chaos, and then at that point there'll be financial chaos. So what I would say is this is the time to prepare. People who listen to our show in the United States, I would say it isn't enough to, you know, be armed and have food. You really need to set up communication. You need to sit down and think about who you can trust and count on during really serious, violent circumstances, because that could, I mean, this is a prediction, who knows what will happen, but I'm just saying it's high enough in terms of probability that I would, if I was living in a vulnerable area, a suburb attached to a place that Antifa BLM could headquarter, boy, I would sure be preparing now, not just in terms of provisions and arms, but in terms of how they would communicate with one another. You know? How they can organize.
And see if someone's delivering a pallet of bricks. There is in Chicago, where bricks were delivered on a pallet. The bricks were
traced all over the place.
Yeah, bricks were traced.
We had bricks in Los Angeles.
Bricks were traced to a construction company owned by the Pritzker family. Of course, the governor of Illinois, it's Pritzker. And he has a sign of the banking family, which created Barack Obama, the former president, of course. And Barack Obama, and Timothy Rahm Emanuel is an agent of the Pritzkers, a former mayor of Chicago. But Barack Obama has a point. I think Lightfoot was a U.S. attorney, appointed Lightfoot as a U.S. attorney in, was she in Ohio when she was there? And also Nessel out in Michigan was also a U.S. attorney that was appointed by Barack Obama, I think at one point, got her career. And then she was elected attorney general in Michigan. But the point being is the bricks that are being thrown can be traced back to a company owned by the family of the governor of the state of Illinois.
Yeah, it's sad, but should give the middle class, the Gentile middle class, a clear indication of what the future holds. Mm-hmm. Look at the military camp that was discovered and filmed in Portland, mm-hmm. Which was being funded, it turned out, by the city government, the same government that is responsible for maintaining order, was funding the military camp of the rioters who for 100 days had been destroying the city. So you can see the malevolence. I mean, isn't it clear?
To impanel grand juries. They exist. And grand juries, I know people who've gotten or don't know about this, but we do have grand juries, and they represent the people. And they can be impaneled to investigate these prosecutors, these DAs. They can bring them in, ask questions, and all this. They can even, you know, this is corruption, and they can investigate this network that's apparently nationwide in waging this revolution that they're you know.
Find out where the money's coming.
Yeah. And you, right now, you have an FBI director saying, "Well, it's not a group, an organization, it's just a movement. It's just sort of this airy fairy, they don't have communications or bank accounts and all that." No, you investigate it. You know, draw a schematic. Develop a conspiracy theory, if you will. That's what they do to go after the mob. You know, and you identify capos and godfathers and soldiers, and you work your way up. You can prosecute. Instead of releasing these people, they should arrest them and throw the book at them.
They are obviously under control. And this is an enormous problem, Tim, mm-hmm. because when the government is organized against the people, the government has a tremendous advantage in terms of destruction.
Well, that's what people have to realize. It's again this at this it's like when Lincoln, take it back to the slavery issue, politics, when Lincoln gave his speech, House, you know, divided as House cannot stand, and he pointed a finger at the planter class in the South for dividing the country. Well, no, he was right though. There were interests behind the political scenes that were manipulating the situation. It was the financial class that was looking to foment a war and change the whole political process of the country, change the banking financial system, and make a whole lot of money in the process. And they succeeded in doing. They created the sort of this oligarchy that we're living with today. You know, the people to realize is that we have to look at when you look at a, you know, like your governor in Michigan, Whitmore, or Wolf in Pennsylvania, who just got slapped down by a federal judge, by the way. So there is, the system isn't complete. There is resistance within the system, and there's something to be gained, I think, still by pursuing legal, through legal channels, suing. There's
absolutely.
A case in Ohio. Absolutely. There's, you know, at the very least, you can embarrass them. Well, that's almost impossible, I think. But you can point out the fact that they're not following their own rules, and you might get, get some action on that end, because the federal judge did declare Governor Wolf's lockdown unconstitutional, and you have this lawsuit with Tom Renz in Ohio, which, if it proceeds, this massive lawsuit, they could actually subpoena people like Fauci and Burks, and even the governors to come in and give testimony to provide evidence for their claim of an actual emergency. Say, what's your basis for this claim? And if you get cross-examination evidence, I'm not saying this will work, but I'm saying this is one avenue. Another avenue is civil disobedience, you know, of course.
Well, but there's two great reasons for the legal approach. One, it creates a venue in which the facts are brought out.
Yeah.
You when you have an attorney who has the power of you know, inside of court, you can't stop the information from coming out. So the sophistry concerning the virus will just be self-evident. And then the other thing is, the second great reason for doing legal action against the government is that when the government ignores what the information, the clear information indicates, this really wakes people up. In Australia, you've had a collection of judges come forward and say that the new slavery law that Andrews is proposing is, you know, is illegal. They've citing all of these precedents and actual reasons why under the Australian Constitution you can't do this. And even though I think they'll fail, and I think the so-called omnibus bill will pass, the fact that they came forward and brought that legal position will convert a larger fraction of the normies than almost anything else. So I really hope that people bring as many lawsuits as possible, because you get both information and you get that the public isn't aware of. And then you expose the malevolence of the political class. You expose them as dictators, not really even playing by the rules of law.
Yeah, yeah. And that's when you have that recognition or consciousness on a sizable minority of the public, then you might get some action, some change, at least some resistance to it. And then you'll get the normal political operators who will see the political opportunity in taking that position, hopefully, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's more important over the next month than ever before that the independent media attempts to communicate with the normie, because it's critical that the normie respond to the coming chaos in the right way, that he understands that it was deliberately brought by the government against him. If that can, you know, that if that process can be put into place by the independent media, it's going to be so much better, because if you have, you know, millions and millions of people aware that the COVID, for example, just the pandemic was fake, and that the lockdown was done to weaken them, then you'll have a much quicker time of rebelling. So it's really important the next month that we really try to reach out to the normie, make the case, and even if we don't convert them, just put the grammar in his mind or her mind that this is deliberate. This isn't just history unfolding.
Yeah, the judge in the case of Pennsylvania said that Governor Wolf's position was a gross overreach. Even if there was an emergency, there's no justification for suspending the Constitution the way that he has. And so if that is indeed true, shouldn't there be some consequence for a governor that does that? I mean, he does swear an oath.
He just swore. He should be arrested.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, wait a second. I mean, it's almost like, six separate tyrannus, right? There's got to be some consequence. If there's no consequences for these things, for these gross overreaches, as he said, or overstepping or violation of the Constitution, then, what's the deterrent from doing it when they have everything to gain from doing it, as we can see? So again, there has to be some consequences for what's going on. And the only way that can happen is if there's a broad public recognition that there's been a breach of trust and a vast power grab on behalf of very few people. And that's
I tell you, Tim, it's getting harder and harder to be a normie.
Yeah, I think we're we'll talk about in the future.
Antifa's success in destroying the cities, when you look at the rationale behind the lockdowns just collapsing, the question should be arising that, well, what is in back of that? Because this cannot be occurring under the normal cultural understanding of America.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe
there has to be something else in play here other than the normies' worldview. Otherwise, these things couldn't be going on in the method and the power that they are.
Yeah, maybe in the near future we'll talk about the coming radicalization of the normie.
I'll tell you. Let's hope that happens. And I do think that it is coming. I just hope that as it comes forward, that it's accompanied by the right intellectual understanding.
Yeah. Oh, it's very easily manipulated. Yes, that's like,
it's so easy to manipulate. This is why they're. I'm sure this is why they've created this dialectic.
Well, it's the whole idea of white.
And they can put in the leader on the white horse who they will follow off a cliff.
Yeah, the whole idea of white supremacist, where there'd be a bunch of white guys defending. Look at this white supremacist, and that's why they're setting themselves up for this. And you could see something in next month going into the election where they have these protests. And perhaps the same thing you saw like in Ukraine or in the Balkans, the 90s, where you have snipers taking people out,
I think that's absolutely coming.
Yeah.
I think that they're in order, if their intention, which it seems clear as a bell to me, is to have a race war, then the use of snipers will, just set it off because they can take out 100 peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters. In other words, they can create the exact storyline that will just put race riots into motion all across the United States.
Well, that's the importance of the politics of slavery, is the guilt, the institution of white guilt, the psychological effect it has on the white population. And you saw this during the civil rights era, when these laws were passed, the vast majority of whites, particularly those in the North, saw it as a reform aimed at the South, which was considered retrograde and backward. But immediately it was applied in the North, and they didn't see themselves having a particular race problem in the North. Nevertheless, it was used against them. The vast majority of white people saw it as an act of justice and magnanimity on their part. It was portrayed as blacks as an admission of guilt. And this is something that can be exploited, because then through the cultural Marxism, critical theory, you can impose this sort of psychological, outlook or view of people where they're guilty, and also when you're the guilty, they really can't defend themselves, but they're the majority still. But wait, you just are them psychologically with white guilt in the civil rights narrative and the slavery narrative, sort of single out white people, as they're called, as being particularly guilty, despite the fact that oppression, man's inhumanity to man, slavery itself, was a global phenomenon, existed all throughout time. it was unique in the West where it was ended.
Like in the Star Spangled Banner, when they talk about the hirelings and the mm-hmm. slaves, right, which would be the Irish and the Black.
There's an interesting story in Liberia. The first ex-slaves went to Liberia.
Yeah.
They went to Liberia and enslaved the Africans there. So
I know. Well, that's, species, we have some rough edges.
Exactly, but, yeah. But the point is, there's something uniquely evil about white people, though. I mean, it's, yeah.
What I'm worried about, Tim, is the logic. If I extend the logic of the malevolent construction and purpose for Black Lives Matter and Antifa, if I take that into the period of the election and during a contested moment, and then I add to that a false flag, where they can use long range snipers to kill 40 some big number of peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters, blame it on white supremacists, and then encourage the Antifa Black Lives Matter then to take this into the suburbs, to take the battle to them after they've slaughtered your people. Now you've got the extension of the logic, right? This is the race war that I think they're trying to.
Well, if you're like at a bunch of white guys, you got some friends, and you're talking, drinking beer around the campfire, or meeting at the local pub, if you will, if you can't anymore, or whatever, lockdowns, and you're talking about doing something, and all of a sudden some guy shows up, so says, we should do something, and I got some money, let's go buy some guns. That guy's a Fed. Don't listen to him.
It's sad, because I think the way it's constructed, the whites are going to have to defend themselves at some point, because I think they're going to be successful in bringing Antifa into the suburbs.
Well,
I think it's already happening, and I think once they're there, the race war will be exploited for all it's worth.
Well, that's the importance of psychological warfare and instituting white guilt and white supremacy, is that even right now, with the white majority being closely roughly 2/3 of the country, if you take citizenship, they're probably still up over 70%, because I think that takes into account illegal aliens. But nevertheless, I mean, you couldn't have a race war and expect it to the other side to win with those numbers. But like Sun Tzu, right, the art of war, you conquer them psychologically. You never have to fire a weapon. Is if you instill them with white guilt, with the civil rights narrative, the slavery narrative, this unique white guilt for oppression of colored people, particularly blacks, then they won't have the psychological wherewithal, despite their numbers, to fight back. And you see that among all classes of white people, particularly the upper income white people, because if you drive around, it's kind of funny. The two areas we see Black Lives Matter signs would be the black neighborhoods and the upper income white neighborhoods.
and on cars and trucks going through black neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Right, guys.
but the thing is,
they don't want to get dragged out of their car. Yeah,
but what white guilt does, though, what white guilt does with these narratives is that it frustrates or prevents a coalescence of white interests, if be that as it may. I mean, you destroy any sense of community with this stuff, because the white people are too divided to defend themselves. There's no sort of a cohesion among the white majority that's very divided, because for the longest time they haven't had to do that, because the system was kind of their system. This was, in essence, when they say white supremacy, they're talking about our system, right? And so their idea of white supremacy is the judicial system, the rule of law, the laws in place, the customs and these things. Well, this is the way it was, because America was European.
You don't pull people out of cars and you don't break windows at retail shops. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like showing up on time, as like that plaque read, showing up on time for work.
You get that list. You have white characteristics. So.
Yeah. It was just that's characteristics of an orderly, productive, wealthy society. Call it white if you want, fine. If it's white supremacy, sign me up. But I mean, say, come on. I mean, it's ridiculous. But this is what they're doing. And so, but if you have a huge cohort of the white population that internalizes that white guilt, or it was driven to sort of a virtue signal, they're not going to their politics, their attitudes aren't going to be the type that allows for any coalescence. I'm not even talking about like immediate military or physical reasons. I'm talking about a coalescence where, you know, your politics is such that it forces the political system to respond to your interests. Right now, there's white interests aren't considered legitimate because they're white interests. They're termed white interests. Of course, the white community is much more diverse than that. It's not just white. It's that's a very crude characterization of European American people, Americans of European, you know, lineage. You know, which,
yeah, all of the intellectual constructions in our head, the grammar that we automatically go to, are products of the culture of critique.
Yes, so we've done it ourselves. Yeah,
school and the authoritarian personality. I mean, they've been so successful in both getting us to buy into these things and then by dominating the media.
Well, the broader white culture is a product of social engineering and, of course, in and of itself.
But this will change, of course, when you have violence. When there's blood, everything changes.
But here was a good example. Me, Michael Jones points out is like when they were trying to take down Louis the Ninth statue in St. Louis, the agitator for that was a white Muslim who was being urged on by the local synagogue, by a rabbi, radical lady rabbi down there. But he tried to label the protesters at the St. Louis statue as white supremacists, and they were Catholics.
Yeah.
And so all these Catholics came up identifying as Catholics, and it blunted it because they showed up and there was like a black lady saying the rosary.
Well, and also the concept is so preposterous that it didn't resonate with the people who were saying the rosary.
Yeah.
They knew they weren't there saying the rosary because they're white supremacists. So it was only for the PR of the broader public, but the people who were saying the rosary, trying to defend the statue, they became emboldened and stood up to them. And so this will hopefully be a process that repeats itself as we go forward, because when you have defense of the suburbs, I think the guilt of political correctness will start to fall off of a lot of the normies, you know, as they reach for their AR to defend themselves.
Yeah, like that liberal couple in St. Louis, right?
Yeah, well, for example. and this, coupled with the information that has come forward and is coming forward from the independent media, could create a very interesting situation. I'm not sure that everything, I mean, I know that, you know, the Masonic controllers try to work this stuff out like, you know, balls on a pool table, you know, using Newton motion. I mean, just down to the last, you know, kind of combination. But there is an existential component here. You've got so many whites now aware of the potential of government malevolence and the questioning as to what the government is. I mean, look at the vaccine resistance now.
And
I think the longer the lockdown goes, you know, you're going to have more and more people, you know, with at least a question mark occurring that will wait. What is government? Why are they behaving like this? So that when in a couple months, when we get into the violence phase, it's my prediction, it could end differently than the Masonic controllers think, in that you could actually create a backbone and some steel and some awareness of our real situation in the world. And the Gentiles might be a little difficult to disarm. So, you know, looking at what's in front of us, I think we should pay attention to Victoria. I think, as I said last week, that's the avant-garde. I think that the slave state they're creating there, and to the extent they're successful, is what they are preparing for all of us. We hope that the people in Melbourne can resist. They are without weapons.
Yes, however. Yeah.
And so it's a little different for them. It's a shame, isn't it, Tim, that there isn't some magical financing of weapons to help these people resist tyranny. You know, I mean, it's just a shame that couldn't or isn't happening, because it would be a different situation in Melbourne if they were trying to take the children away from 5 million people that owned automatic rifles.
Yeah. Yeah, instead of they have to like pull out spoons and forks or something to just
Well, it just they, you know, sad to say, the people I've been talking to in Melbourne have been saying that the global homo culture is well ensconced there, and that the bloke culture is kind of on the way out. The males are weak.
Yeah.
Which has been demonstrated by the events, but this is not to say they cannot rally when they're, you know, presented with real threat to their children. So we'll see. It's a shame that that they aren't armed. I think that's one, obviously one of the reasons why they disarmed that region a few years ago, so that when they put the slave state in, that they wouldn't have to worry about their administrators being shot. We'll see. You know, humans are resourceful, particularly when you take kids away.
Yeah, they might get to hold on some firearms at that point.
They might. Who knows? I mean, some of these people actually might know people who can smuggle something in. I'm just speculating. But if that happened, then it could be a little bit different, because looking at the police, it's a very pretty thin brigade. I mean, think of how difficult it has to be to train these people to present fascism to their own people. I mean, it, you know, this is must be a hard thing to do. And that's why when they, in the bill, in the omnibus bill, they talk about being able to appoint these individuals. I have a feeling that these people will not be from the region or even from Australia. I think that the these overseers will be of a different guild. But nevertheless, you know, in Melbourne, I hope that somehow they're able to defend themselves. And I think if I was there, I'd really be trying hard to find ways to do it right now.
And it's interesting, of course, even in Australia, they had their own Black Lives Matter protests there to psychologically disarm the white majority. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. In Melbourne, the people mention that all the time. They go, well, why are we, like, we can't leave our house except for an hour a day, and we have to be 6 feet away, and we can't even go to, you know, our church, when the Black Lives Matter protests without masks can just go wherever they want and not be fined or imprisoned. So the malevolent rationale of government should be clearer and clearer. I hope the people in Melbourne understand that it's a waste of time to think about legal process. The legal process is something the oligarchs control. They need to think about asymmetrical defense at this point.
Yeah, yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
Yep, that's unfortunate. That's truth.
So, okay, Joe, good luck.
Jim, have a great weekend. God, it's a pleasure talking to you, buddy. We'll get him next week, okay?
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Yeah, bye-bye.